I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Our guest says that there have been five times in the 550 million years that diverse life has occupied Earth, and it's beginning to look like another is happening. It's mass extinction. The sixth mass extinction is happening right now, says our guest, Professor Anthony Barnosky, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology, curator in the Museum of Paleontology and Research Paleoecologist at the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the author of Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Anthony Barnosky, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. So what are the signs that the sixth mass extinction is happening right now?
Well, if we look at what's happened over the past couple of centuries, we know that we've caused many, many species to already go extinct. Percentage-wise, it doesn't sound like that much, about 1% of the species that have ridden the planet with us for the past 12,000 years are now extinct because of our activities. Even more worrisome is what we've seen over the past 40 years, and that is we have killed about half of the world's wildlife, and we've fished about 90% of the big fish out of the sea.
Wow.
So we know that extinction rates are very much accelerated relative to what's normal.
Half of the world's wildlife. How in the world do we do that?
It's basically by using land and sea that they used to use for their purposes, for our purposes, that is to support humanity. Just on land, we've actually converted about 50% of Earth's lands into habitats that are designed to support people rather than other species. Most of that is agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And you said 90% of the fish?
90% of the big fish. So if you look at the catch records going back several decades, and you know, a great way to do it is just to look at old pictures of fishermen standing on the dock and seeing what their big fish looked like. If you go back to the early part of the century, you would see people holding fish that were as big as their bodies or larger, hoisted up on a hoist. Now, if you look at people catching the same species, they're 1 or 2 feet long at the most.
Mm. So what we've done is we've essentially thought about ourselves, and we haven't thought about providing for the needs of other species.
Yeah, that's right. We've been basically viewing nature as this inexhaustible resource, kind of like, you know, having a checking account that is just bottomless, that you can keep writing checks on. We now know that's not the way it works. Nature is more like an interesting bearing account, and what we have to get in the habit of doing is living off the interest.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, there are a lot of stories in the book, and there's this absolutely beautiful picture of Lonesome George 10 months before he died, and you had a chance, I believe, to meet Lonesome George right before he died. Tell us the story of Lonesome George and why you start the book with his story.
Well, Lonesome George is one of the tortoises that used to live on the Galapagos Islands. And when the Galapagos Islands were first discovered by people, those big tortoises, and they kind of look like Volkswagens walking around with these fire hose necks and yodel-like faces. When the islands were first discovered, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 tortoises. By the time, middle of last century, they were down to about 2,000 individuals. Now, they were divided into many different subspecies. Lonesome George was a member of one of those subspecies. And the reason his story is special is because we watched that subspecies go extinct. Mm. Lonesome George died a little over a year ago, and it was such a big deal in the world that we had witnessed this extinction of an entire subspecies that it really made headlines around the world.
Mm-hmm. That must have been hard.
Yeah, it's, you know, when we can actually see extinctions before our very eyes, you begin to realize what's going on. There are, unfortunately, all too many examples of watching species disappear very rapidly off the face of the earth. Even our most iconic large mammals, for example, elephants. Right now, there's a huge problem with elephant poaching, driven mainly by the trade for their ivory, which is used in curios. This is big business for the international drug and terrorist groups. They profit so much off of illegally selling these ivory tusks that if poaching kept up at the same rate it's been for the past few years, there would be no more wild animal, no more wild elephants left on Earth in 20 years.
Mm. And it is, and I can't imagine what it's used for other than some kind of status symbol. Look, I've made it. I've got ivory on my shelf. What else would you use it for?
That is all it's used for, basically. Yeah, so that's what's driving it, is people just wanting ivory curios. So, you know, here's clearly an example of if it was possible to get the message out and dry up the demand for ivory curios, there would be no reason to kill elephants.
So do you assume that most of those people who are displaying the curios have no knowledge that these elephants in the wild could be extinct very soon?
Yes, I think that's exactly the case. That it turns out when people become alerted to this fact, they tend not to want to buy ivory curios anymore.
Yeah. Well, going back to Lonesome George, it doesn't give you much hope. I know you're a man with hope, and that's good. But you look at how old he was when he died, and he was over 100 years, which meant that we had a long period of time to get this right, and we didn't do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is it's a distressing story, but actually there's also a hopeful story there, too, mm-hmm. and that Lonesome George represents one subspecies of the entire species that makes up Galapagos tortoises. And it was the entire species that was down to 2,000 individuals. Once the people in Ecuador realized how dire the situation was on the Galapagos, not only for the tortoises, but for many other species, there were a series of measures put into place to turn that into one of the world's amazing natural areas with appropriate not only protection, but also nurturing the species back to health. And again, using those tortoises as an example, they were down to 2,000 individuals. And now, because the tortoises are, in fact, the eggs are collected, taken to a breeding center, hatched, the tortoises are reared until they're of a size when they can survive more easily in the wild, taken back to the nesting sites from which the eggs were originally removed. Through that process and various laws and international protection, the number of tortoises for the whole species has now grown back up from 2,000 to 19,000 species. 19,000 animals. So, you know, that shows us we can actually save a species when we put our minds to it.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that we need, you talk about how many people are on this planet now and how 2 billion more we're going to be adding in a fairly short period of time. So how much space it is we need to feed everybody, and can you feed everybody, all those billions of people, and still keep alive the tortoises or the elephants or have enough land for them to graze and to stay alive?
Yeah, so this is one of the big issues going into the future. And, you know, one of the big issues that's been driving the extinction crisis so far is simply that we need a lot of the planet to support the 7 billion people that are now on it. As we go into the future, any demographic model that you come up with right now puts somewhere around 9 to 10 billion people on the planet by mid-century. So that's a reality we have to live with. How do we feed not only those 7 billion on the planet today, but also those 2 or 3 billion more that are coming by mid-century without taking over more of what is now natural area, that is primarily rainforest and things like that, to grow more food? Well, it turns out that we have it in our capacity to not take over more of the landscape to grow food by implementing some more efficient measures of agriculture where we're already growing crops, by wasting less food, and by eating less meat. We can actually make that work.
Mm. Are we starting to do that?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the awareness is just now beginning to grow that we need to do that. So certainly people in the food security community are now talking about different ways to grow food that are both more efficient in terms of using fewer resources, less fertilizers, and so on, and also environmentally more friendly. Those technologies are, in fact, out there. They're being developed. Clearly, the wastage problem is one we can we're aware of, and we can fix that one. We waste about a third of the food that's grown right now.
Wow.
In developed countries, it's you know, pretty much we throw it away because we put too much on our plate, so we don't like the way the fruit looks in the supermarket, so that's thrown away. In developing countries, it's more an issue of distribution, getting the crops from market to the consumer. So, again, those are things that are not all that hard to fix once we put our mind to it. And then, you know, the eating less meat thing is pretty important, too, because if we were to devote all of the cropland that we're now devoting to feeding livestock to directly growing crops to feed people, we would have something like 30 to 50% more calories for the world. So, you know, these are all doable things, but again, it takes awareness and initiative to get the job done.
Yes. Before we go to phone calls, and we have many of them, I want to ask you about some of the other extinctions, the five other mass extinctions. Can you briefly describe the ones that may be most pertinent to us now, what we can learn from those that might be most important in history to the current one?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, the one that people tend to hear most about is the dinosaur extinction. That took place about 66 million years ago, and that one was actually caused by a big asteroid coming out of the sky and smashing into Earth, so that was a bad afternoon for life.
Right.
The other one that is getting a lot of press these days is called the Great Dying or the End Permian extinction. That was about 252 million years ago. And that one was caused by massive volcanic eruptions that over the course of a few thousand years elevated greenhouse gases, primarily CO2 in the atmosphere, had a lot of the same effects that we're seeing today by our burning of fossil fuels in terms of elevating global temperature some 6 to 8 degrees Celsius, causing ocean acidification. Now, it turns out that those sorts of changes actually were operative in each of the Big Five mass extinctions, even though each one of them had a different immediate cause. The downstream effects tended to be changes in climate, changes in atmospheric chemistry, changes in ocean chemistry, exactly the kinds of things that we have been doing at an accelerated pace to the planet today.
We're going to take phone calls for our guest, and we'll do so in just one moment. Anthony Barnosky is with us. He's the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. He's a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology, curator in the Museum of Paleontology, and research paleoecologist in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at the University of California, Berkeley. Also author previously of Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming. Here's how you reach us and this conversation. If you'd like to be on air, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You're also welcome to send an email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. What an interesting topic. As I listen, it feels as if a rare and precious keepsake has been given to a child too small and just too careless to realize what he's holding. Hmm. And the guest is telling us, you know, we may fumble and drop it before we're even mature enough to appreciate and protect what we've been given. In fact, what we're an inextricable part of. But the examples in Professor Barnosky's comments, which offer hope, suggest that another end of the story is also possible, that we could, you know, yet rise to the occasion. Our plight is so often cast in the media in such sad and seemingly irrevocable terms. You know, look at this problem our forebears have created. Look what we've been stuck with. But we could also look at this as a tremendous and, in fact, an unprecedented opportunity. This is an extinction we could actually turn around or at least mitigate the worst outcomes. We have free will. We can work against what has been cast as inevitable. We'd have to fundamentally change our relationship with our environment, but we do have the knowledge to do this. And I see the question as whether or not we can marshal the will.
Well, you know, I think you are absolutely on target in what you just said. This looming extinction is very different than all the past Big Five mass extinctions in that we actually know what's causing it and we know how to fix it. Fixing it basically requires shifting over to a carbon neutral energy system by about mid-century. It requires the adjustments to our food growing system that I mentioned a little while ago. And it requires actually putting a monetary value in nature in ways that it can be integrated into the world economic system. We actually know how to do that. We're doing it in some cases. But we have to do it a lot faster. And people oftentimes say, oh, this is such a big problem, you can't solve it. And my response to that is, well, look, we accomplished the Green Revolution. We built enough paved highway just in this country within 30 to 40 years to encircle the Earth twice. We've seen the Internet Revolution. I mean, people are darned amazing. Once they know there's a problem and want to fix it, we can usually fix it. So I totally agree with you. If the awareness is there, we've got the capability to prevent this from happening.
And you highlight some people who are really concerned about the issue and are trying to change things. Tell us a little bit about this group, CEOs, actually, who comprise Vision 2050.
Yeah, Vision 2050 is kind of an interesting initiative. So There's a group of CEOs called the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. And, you know, these are most of the big companies that come to mind when you think of the big money makers in the world. These are corporations, many of which have a gross annual income and expenditure that is more than most of the countries in the world. It's the CEOs that make up this group, and there's a subset of those CEOs that got together a few years ago and began looking at, all right, by mid-century, we still want to be able to make money, but we realize there's going to be 9 billion people, 10 billion people on the planet. We realize we have all these environmental issues. So how do we get from here to there and still make it all work? And they came up with this plan called Vision 2050, which actually addresses many of these problems that I point out in the book, having to do with power and food and money, and lay out what milestones have to be met each decade in order to make it work, and how to get from, you know, where we are now to there. So the point being is, even at the highest levels in the business community, these are problems that are being taken seriously. What also has to happen is these problems have to be taken seriously at the grassroots level to give both business leaders and our political leaders the power they need to make the top-down changes happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carl, for your insightful comments, as always. Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hello. You have a good day. When I was a child, I used to collect butterflies and moths, and I would catch, sometimes when we had a party at the pool, 2,000 monarchs. I mean, I'm not lying. They would all be drunk and on the clover, and I would pick them off. They had their wings fold, especially in August, and take them home, fill a jar up, open the top, and they would come out like an orange volcano. I used to collect hair streaks and skippers, and when my daughter was a baby, I would pick Polyphemus and Cecropia and Promethea cocoons from around here off their food plants, and I'd put them all in a cage and let them hatch in early June, and they would all open their wings up and breed, and I'd let them go, but the kids, they just freaked out watching these moths open their wings. I haven't been able, I used to smell frogs. I haven't been able to find a cocoon or a caterpillar of a Saturnidae in 20 years plus. I used to sell frogs, I'm not salamanders, but the mud puppies of both the little black one with this little speckles, light blue speckles on it, and the tiger salamander. I used to sell their mud puppies for bait, and I used to be able to get thousands of them. When you would walk through the grass, it would move in front of you because it was so many frogs. They're all gone, and I know why they're gone. We come up with all these pesticides, and we have Republican senators. Now, I don't want to be political, but we have these Republican senators who are bought out by the drug by the pesticide companies, and they will not allow even stopping arsenic in our water. We have places where there's more than 200 parts per million arsenic in our water, and they're telling the people to get water purifiers.
All right, I need to hold you there. I have a feeling that you've stored a lot up, and we have to get to other calls. But Professor Baranowski, what do you make of his observations?
Well, so, you know, I think that you're not alone in those observations. In just about any part of the country, really any part of the world, people are saying the same sorts of things. And, you know, the sorts of changes you are seeing in your local area are a combination of in the case of the insects, I suspect a lot of that has to do with climate changes that affect not only the local environment, but the connection between the biology of those species and the progression of the seasons, their migration routes, and so on. So, that's absolutely a huge problem. And, you know, if you think about climate change with respect to what it's doing to the species on Earth today, it's a very underappreciated problem because we're actually changing climate faster than most of those species have ever experienced in their evolutionary history. If we actually get to 6 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of this century, which is exactly what we're on track to do, that would be 10 times faster rate of change than most species living today have ever witnessed. Mm. And it would be taking Earth to a whole new climate level than most species have ever witnessed. Last time we had temperatures 6 degrees Celsius warmer on average was about 14 million years ago. So that's the nature of the problem. And what you're observing already is the early stage of that. What you mentioned about pesticides and pollutants, that too is a big issue, and it goes back to the way that we actually, a lot of it goes back to the way we tend to grow food now with overuse of pesticides, overuse of fertilizers, and so on. What we really need to be going for is much more of what people in the food business like to call a Goldilocks strategy, which is just the right amount, mm-hmm. Not too little, not too much.
Thank you, Greg, very much for your call. Edie in Janesville, hi.
Hello. We need to do a lot of things, obviously, but one thing we really need to do is to radically change our mindset about who we are. I'm reading a book called Ishmael. I think it's by Peter Quinn. Have you heard of that?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to badly paraphrase the book, but two of the things he says is we are just really living and believing in the wrong story, that we, mankind, believes that all of evolution existed just to create man, and that we're the end stop, and that the second part is that we believe we have dominion over everything. And that's not new. We've heard that before. But I found the first thing he said, Ishmael says, about that all of evolution, the whole purpose of evolution was just to create man, that is what we believe. And I found that very interesting. And I think there's some really truth to that, people believe that we are the end-all and be-all of evolution.
Well, I know one of your recommendations, Anthony Barnowski, is that we all spend more time out in the natural world, that if you're walking among beings in the natural world and everything on the ground and in the sky, you're much more attuned to all that you're talking about right now. We can live pretty far removed from all of the species that Edie was talking about.
Well, yeah, I think there is this mindset that has evolved over the years that people are somehow apart from nature and not governed by the same laws as other species, which, of course, is absolutely untrue. We've always been an integral part of our environment and vice versa. We depend on other species, and we actually control a lot of the destiny of other species. It's a very interconnected thing. One of the things you said is also really interesting to think about, that people get really happy when they're outside,
right,
in green places.
Uh-huh.
There's just something about it at the genetic level, and it's actually, it translates even to the economic level. It turns out that some of the highest real estate values tend to be in the most biodiverse places. Within any given community, for example, the places that have a lot of green space and so on tend to fetch higher prices than the places that are completely paved over. So we like nature. People do feel this connection. And I think especially these days where we're so many of us are living in more or less urbanized environments, we tend to lose track of that connection, and we tend to think that the remaining natural places are inexhaustible and will always be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we're using them up so fast in ways we don't even think about that we're in danger of losing them.
Edie, thanks very much for the call. Spend a moment talking about, you say early on, you when you list all the things that you've been pondering, and they're huge, huge subjects, that you've been thinking about your children, too, and your children having to grow up and deal with the world that we've left them. You write, "My world, my hope is that their world will be at least as good as ours is now, and my optimistic side wants to believe that it will be." Tell me what you think your children will be seeing, and what kind of worry, how you take that very personally. We all do, when you look at the people who will come after us.
Sure. Well, you know, when I say a world at least as good as it is now, I mean a world that is providing them with the economic opportunities, the comfort that we tend to take for granted, as well as a world that allows them the opportunity to get out and see and experience some of these wild places that I've had the good fortune to grow up around and visit. So sort of the whole package that we have today. Now, my fear is that if we keep these pressures on other species that are accelerating extinction rates, that have already accelerated extinction rates. I mean, right now, we know there are more than 20,000 species that are threatened with extinction. We just kept going as we're going. Concrete example, many of those species are the species that build coral reefs in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if coral reefs disappear, which is all too plausible by 2070, that means that 25% of the life in the oceans disappear because coral reefs support a lot of other species. That means not only could my kids not have the opportunity to go see beautiful coral reefs, it means that billions of dollars would be lost because 10% of the world's fisheries would collapse. It means that in some of the poorest parts of the world that rely on those fisheries for the protein they need, people would be going hungry, would be in economic strife, would escalate into regional conflicts, and you begin to see a world that is not as pleasant as the world we're living now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Eugene and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. We've got companies that have been doing frac sand mining here in southern Wisconsin, and that oil, that sand is used in oil production. And I'm wondering how that mining is going to affect water tables and also the environment. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Eugene.
The whole issue of climate change is, of course, driven by our use of fossil fuels. So anything that contributes to increased production of fossil fuels is probably exactly the wrong thing to be doing these days if we're going to take this extinction problem seriously. Now, that being said, there is a bit of a reality in that we can't switch over our whole energy system overnight. It actually will take a couple of decades, and in the interim, the idea is to go from the dirtiest fossil fuels to the cleanest fossil fuels to non-fossil renewables. So that interim fuel tends to be natural gas. In a lot of cases, fracking is to produce gas deposits or gas reserves. So I wouldn't categorically say that fracking is not to be done. I'd say done right, interim solution. But the idea is to get off of fossil fuels as fast as possible. And there's no doubt that there are some bad practices out there that are affecting local areas in bad ways.
Mm-hmm. Some of the other things, you wrote a piece about 10 things that people can do to prevent the continuation of the sixth mass extinction. You talk about, and this just sounds like a good thing to do for the holiday season too, so I wanted to bring it up. Actually, it made me think, oh, I can do this. To adopt a species or become a citizen scientist, that's an interesting thing to do, to adopt an elephant or to become personally invested in this issue, because it's something you would think about all the time, right?
Yeah, you know, I think it's something that is a very concrete action that actually is helpful. And there, you know, you can just Google adopt a species, and there's any number of organizations out there that make it possible to do that. But here, you know, again, interesting way to think about this. So one of the species that is in most peril today actually are rhinoceroses. There's about five different species of rhinoceroses. They're all in trouble. And they too are in trouble from poaching, primarily because their horns are very valuable in the traditional Chinese medicine trade. Mm-hmm. They have all kinds of purported health uses, none of which, by the way, bear up under scrutiny. So poaching is a real problem. Here's how bad a problem it is. When I was in South Africa last summer, I had the good fortune to see some rhinos, and the person who was with me said, well, what you don't see is there's a guy out there with an automatic weapon in the bushes, because these rhinos are protected 24/7 by an armed guard. That's the only thing keeping them alive. So when you adopt a species, the kinds of things that money goes to are hiring those armed guards.
Oh my.
That can be a very direct benefit.
Let's go to Vivian in Green Bay. Hello, Vivian.
Just probably within the last month on public television, it was the fifth year of their study regarding the melting of the ice floes in the Arctic. And, of course, I'd always known about the plight of the grizzly. But what they discovered after tagging and GPS narwhals and killer whales and bull whales, that without that ice cover, the narwhal in particular is a sitting duck. It has no defenses against the orcas. The orcas used to be kept out of the Arctic by the ice packs because with their large dorsal fins, they weren't able to surface as much for air among those ice floes. And when they hunted the narwhal, this particular pod, they just wiped out the whole pod. And we know they're absolutely awesome predators, but how on earth is anything like that ever going to be controlled? It's a natural thing for the orca to do, but we've taken away the environmental protection from the narwhal and the young bull whales.
Well, yeah. So, you know, this is, again, exactly the problem with the kinds of climate changes we are seeing. Now, if it's if we can hold climate change to somewhere in the ballpark of 2 degrees, we're going to continue to lose that ice. We are going to see some continued changes, but there's a good chance that it won't go so far that we would end up losing the sorts of species you're talking about because of it. We go much above 2 degrees, then all bets are off. And the only way to hold to 2 degrees is, as I said, to pretty much shift off of fossil fuels almost entirely by mid-century. So that's why it's so important to do that. Great observation.
Thank you, Vivian, for your call. We'll take more calls in a moment. And we're speaking this hour with the author of Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Our guest, Anthony Baranowski, writes this, that it's only happened five times in the 550 million years that diverse life has occupied Earth, it's beginning to look like another mass extinction. The sixth mass extinction is happening right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join this conversation about the sixth mass extinction, we have some phone lines open for you right now, and the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And we go next to Christian in Madison. Hi.
Hi, great show. So my question is, what do you say to the climate change naysayers, the deniers, the people that say that it's a liberal propaganda? I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, what evidence you think the listeners could kind of arm themselves with to say, like, well, actually, here's the facts.
Sure. Well, you know, the list of facts is long. And it depends on who you're talking to as to whether or not they will believe them or not. But basically, you know, the fact is we have temperature records that go back a little over 100 years. We've seen a rise of almost 1 degree Celsius in that time. If you compare that with proxies for temperature records that we can get out of the geological and paleontological record, we see that where we are now is already warmer than what is average over the past several million years. And if you do the basic physics on the calculations of putting X amount of greenhouse gases in the air and what is the outcome in terms of rising average global temperature, we see that where we're going is hotter than Earth has been in 15 million years, and we're going to get there within a few decades, okay, if we did nothing differently. That's one set of facts. Another set of facts is maybe a little easier to hit home with, and there's absolutely no doubt that we're seeing more extreme weather. We're seeing more droughts in the western United States. We're seeing more extreme storms and floods in other parts of the country. If you just add up the billion-dollar weather disasters that we've seen over the past decades, we see that there's been more in the past 5 years than there have in the previous 15. So people can look around and see this stuff happening, okay? And those sorts of climate changes are the result of an overall warmer world. You put more heat in the atmosphere and in the oceans, you get more evaporation, you get stronger storms in places where it rains, you know. So just taking a look at the extreme weather events, I think, is a good way to do it as well.
Martin wanted you to focus your attention for a moment on any kind of organization or just the issue of population and keeping the population lower than it's anticipated.
Human population growth?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, ultimately that drives all of these other things. As I said, right now we've got a little over 7 billion people on the planet. If you actually look at sort of the land footprint that each of us requires, on average, globally, each of us requires about 2 acres to live in the manner to which we become accustomed. I mean, that's much less in less developed parts of the world, much more in the U.S., but on average, it's a couple of acres. So if you just, you know, do that simple math and add 3 billion more, you realize that, wow, we're going to have to get a lot more efficient in how we're using resources to make it all work. Now, if you go much more than 3 billion more people, there's really no way to make it work.
Really?
So that's why doing what is necessary to slow population growth and stabilize it at no more than 9 or 10 billion people is so important. Now, how do you do that? Well, it turns out the easiest, most efficient, most beneficial way to do it is simply to ensure that women in who are not in parts of the world where education is readily available to them get a basic level of education. The correlation with a very basic level of education for women and lowering birth rates is dramatic. Also, correlation with basic level of education, rising standards of living for the entire community, better economic health. So, I mean, this is just a beautiful solution to the problem.
Let's go next to Rick in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen. And I appreciate the topic. This is a little on the tangent, though. I'm wondering if anybody is harvesting egg and sperm of these variety of animals that we could then store, freeze, until we maybe have technology to be able to reestablish them. It would mean collecting immense amounts if you wanted to have a viable gene pool. But I'm just wondering, since global warming is already, the snowball is rolling, would this be a preventative measure, and is anybody doing it?
Well, yeah, actually, zoos have been doing this for a long time. So there are those stockpiles being built up. And most recently, there's been a movement towards a something called de-extinction, where scientists are talking about could they actually bring recently extinct species back to life through molecular biology, genetic engineering techniques. You know, my response to all of that is that we're a lot better off doing what we need to do to make sure that species don't go extinct in the first place, because even if it were possible to recreate extinct species by genetic techniques, you can never recreate enough of them with enough genetic variation to truly recreate the species. And, you know, species exist in a context. They exist within an ecosystem that is disappearing. They exist within a sort of parent-offspring relationship where there's a lot of learned behavior that you can never replicate once it's gone. So I think the best that can ever be achieved by the sorts of things you're talking about are to maybe keep a few individuals around as curiosities, but once a species is gone, it's gone forever.
Mm. Thanks, Rick, for the call. Jane in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. What always alarms me when people talk is how unpersonal it seems. A recent study that I was reading was saying that, for example, they were doing a study with big animals like lions or elephants and rhinos, and in one area of the research area, they kept the big animals, and the other ones, they took them out. And what happened is we suddenly had, in the areas where they weren't, small species that would have given us many very bad diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people talk about losing elephants or rhinos, it seems like it's, oh, isn't that sad? But it's personally sad. It's going to hurt us. And it seems, too, that if there's an extinction of other animals, eventually we can't eat. So we will be part of that extinction. It just seems sometimes I would like it to be more emphasized that we are going to hurt, not just that we're going to lose some very, very special animals, but it's the canary in the coal mine.
Mm-hmm. Professor.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we tend to just take what we get back from other species for granted, not even realize where it comes from. And you know, great examples in the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, you know, the sorts of medicines that literally hundreds of millions of people rely on to stay alive if they have high blood pressure come from nature. What one of the original medicines for hypertension was discovered from the venom of a very poisonous snake. With eventually that was developed into a drug that now keeps millions of people alive. So, and that, you know, there's example after example after example of that. So we do get a lot directly back from other species.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Fascinating topic, as is the book. It's Dodging Extinction, Power, Food, Money, and the Future of Life on Earth. Anthony Barnowski is the author and our guest this hour. We thank him for his time. Thank you. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production in Milwaukee.